justice to the people.
The Justice Foundation podcast, from legacy to legal. Conversations and chats about cannabis weekly.
Too much confusion on this land.
Welcome back. It's another episode of the Justice Podcast. And yet again, we've got another Justice Board member on the show to talk about why he joined the board, what it means to him. It's Umi. Umi's part of the, he's a producer and musician, part of the Dead Prez sort of setup. And what impressed me most about your bio is that you'd work with Maceo Parker. So that's cool. When did you do? Yeah. When were you working with him?
Oh man! First of all, I just want to send a shout to you. You know, and any ears that has a moment to hear some of the real information coming off the street. You know, we stay locked into the ground, to the street, and so just want to shout you out for the work you put in. And Maceo Parker, man, that was a while ago, man. That, you know, I actually had a chance to open up for Maceo Parker in Middletown, Connecticut in 1999, maybe, or 2000, something like that. It was a part of the situation. I was actually finishing up Wesleyan University, and they had this competition, yearly competition. Whoever had the best band on the campus got to open up for the biggest concert at the end of the year.
And you got Maceo. Now, well, yeah, I'm very jealous. I've never seen him, but we grew up in the UK in the early 80s as, you know, sort of late teens into all that really hard funk stuff. And yeah, we just love that stuff in that time then. Anyway, I could talk about music forever, but I won't. We're here to talk about the Justice Foundation, and we're here to talk about legacy. Well, what brought you to the Justice Foundation?
I mean, well, you know, I think not to say we don't have to talk about music, because that's the beauty of what the Justice Foundation, I think, enfolds, right? We're talking about something that encompasses the culture of the community. We shift our platform to encompass cannabis, right? That we use that to draw in a world of people, but it doesn't stop there. You know, I think cannabis is the type of social medicine that.
I agree with you totally, but you know, I'm a complete music freak. I have my own little label. You know, it's not the same sort of music as you, but you know, music and cannabis are one. Yet, of course, when money came into cannabis big time on the so-called legal side, nobody ever seems to discuss music and cannabis anymore. It's weird, but there you go.
I mean, the parallels are enormous. And you talk about, like, in terms of my life, you know, I've been blessed to be able to embark on a hip hop career in the late 90s, you know, be able to be signed to Sony Records throughout my career. But bigger than that, I think as you talk about hip hop pioneering to be the genre that kind of echoes the feather of the world and to be the most sellable genre right now in music, check the numbers. I think when you look at how hip hop was co-opted, the idea of something that was derived in the park.
I'm with you. I stopped listening to hip hop in the late 80s.
And I'm a little later, like the late 90s, it kind of dulled out, maybe early 2000. It went strong though. I mean, you know, it's still going, and the possibilities of a new.
Oh yeah, I know. Look, there's some great stuff. I just I'm a Dr. Octagon fan. I'm a Dr. Octagon fan. I'm a Mad Villain fan. But corporate hip hop, I can't be dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, but that echoes what the sentiments of the cannabis industry looks like now and feels like now. Something that started in the belly of the community, and not only that, but thrived. You know, you're talking about an industry that thrived. We didn't need nobody regulating and telling us how to move cannabis forward. That's something that just organically thrived, and the idea of us now being co-opted by the Dwayne Reeds and the you know, Rite Aids and whatever else that's going to come in and manipulate the industry. That's why I said there's is a thin line of separation. And so as the Justice Foundation, back to that original question, I think to try to be involved with something I could move from the ground up, could see the transparency of it. I could look at what's going on in the organization. It was fresh. You know, I was brought in at a very early stage of the organization. I love collaborating with people that have things dear to their heart, that's embodied in making things progress from a street level.
Somebody who's listening who doesn't know about the Justice Foundation, what does it mean to you, and who is it helping, and why does it need to help them?
And so that's what made me truly involved. The Justice Foundation is a 501c3 that's positioned to help the legacy operators, meaning people that engaged in cannabis activity before it was legal. And so the idea of making sure that this community of legacy operators not only have a voice, but also have an opportunity to engage in the legal market now. So the Justice Foundation is paving pivotal roads to make sure that these communities aren't left behind in a moment where the whole industry is being trotted on by big business. I think as a previous, you know, a 30-year legacy operator, that was the first thing that drew me to the Justice Foundation, the practicality of us needing support. You know, we need an organization that has our interests at heart at all times, and it truly is not co-opted by a bigger purpose. And I think I saw the potential in what the Justice Foundation could do. So I said, well, let me see if I could lend my support. And here we are, you know, still trying to grow, still trying to develop, but at the same time, we putting in work, you know. And I think it's been vibrant in the New York level, and now we want to take it beyond New York. And so, you know, it's good to be able to see the progression of the board and the progression of the community that we served as well. You know what I'm saying?
So, I mean, it started as a New York thing. And as we said earlier in the discussion, New York is, we know it's pretty chaotic at the moment. What looks like the perfect picture for justice, people who need justice with New York going forward? Because at the moment, it's not happening. The governor just said that she's going to withdraw a bunch of money to help farmers, of which, of course, you know, a large part of the legacy community are farmers. I mean, where are, how much, there's a lot of work being done in New York. Where are we? And have we actually moved forward anymore to be able to show other states in the US how to bring the legacy community into the regulated community?
Well, you know, I would think, I would love to say that New York is a great state to watch based on the practicality of what we envision New York bringing. Is a center of culture, is a diverse hub of the world. There's so much promise in New York, but no, New York has done a terrible job as it relates of the rollout. It's done a terrible job as it relates to sticking true to the initial plan. It's done a terrible job as it relates to studying the rest of the markets, international and national, and not making the same ignorant mistakes that so many other markets have made.
Why do you think they've made those mistakes? What is it? Do you think it's the simple argument of big money, or is this the lack of knowledge within the administration?
Well, a lot of it is a lack of knowledge. You know, a lot of it is, you know, this is a new industry, right? And so how do you, you know, how do you sharpen new doctors, right? Like, how do you sharpen, you know, up-and-coming surgeons that have the utmost intention to do better in the medical field in all practical senses? Let's look at this, you know. How the fuck do you do that? You know, you go and go get the best doctors that's around, that's been doing this for years, and you make them set up training programs or what have you, and you develop organized situations where new surgeons can have practical.
Well, I'm agreeing with you totally because
right?
education is an afterthought, isn't it? I mean, everybody does everything, and then they say education afterwards rather than.
And we don't want to. We want to look at it as a true industry, right? But we don't want to look at the pioneers of the quote unquote industry, because it was an industry before you guys, you know, big government or whoever's claimed it to be an industry. It was an industry already, but we don't want to look at the pioneers of that and say, well, let's collaborate with what's been working. Let's collaborate with the guys that know what's going on. We have regulations. And how about this? The guys that know what's going on, we still got holes in our plans too, and our efforts. It's certain things that we have never done before. We never figured out, you know, none of this shit as it relates to legal ways. Some people never even got books right. You know, it's a whole lot of holes in both parties. And so instead of us, you know, just communicating, and that's the biggest flaw in all of the United States rollout plans, is no direct communication with the previous, you know, predecessors of this industry, like the guys that made this thing actually work. And we're still alive, like these guys, you know, and people in my mother and father's generation that's still alive, that were doing this prosperously. And I mean, and you know, it's offensive when you get a bunch of regulators coming into our world and trying to tell us what to do in our world, and they don't even have the first clue. And so that's, you know, that's the number one mistake, you know, and I'll also say this in the same breath, you know, we also, because we are revolutionaries, we're not looking at this from no other standpoint. We're revolutionaries over here, you know, so we do count our small victories, you know, as a revolutionary, you have to count your small victories or you won't be able to move on tomorrow sometimes. So it has been progress. I don't want to say all that to say, you know, it's dull and dry. It has been progress. You know, I've seen now, you know, is a little over 100 something, you know, dispensaries that's rolled out in New York State over the last maybe 3-4 months. They were launched out in an unpractical manner as it relates to how they did it, and also as it relates to the support. But they're here, right? And so,
and what percentage do you know, or have you got an idea what percentage of those are run by individual people? They don't have to come from the legacy community, but we're hoping that some of them do. But I mean, in terms of percentages, how many are sort of run by quietly by big organizations, and how many are actually just stores run by people who are running businesses?
I mean, you know, I don't know those exact numbers, so I wouldn't say quote me, but I'll tell you this, you know, it's more than half for sure. You know, that's big business. A lot of, you know, and it's so unfortunate because a lot of even, you know, the first rollout was based, and to me, that was still, you know, it was done wrong, but it was, you know, they gave the first rollout based on prior convictions, anyone that had cannabis related convictions, and you actually were charged in the state of New York.
A lot of people getting licenses and then quietly large companies giving them a little paper envelope and with a bit extra, and quietly
just because you got a charge. Just because you charge doesn't necessarily mean that you are a legacy operator either. You know, I think it's a fine line there.
Yeah.
But you know, I think people that actually bought from legacy operators should have some support in this as well, because they took risk as we took risk. And, you know, so I don't want to get too technical with any of that. But what I will say is, you know, there were no levels of support as promised, you know, for these for these initial licenses. And these are the people that needed the support the most, you know. And once that support kind of was deflated,
basically the administration said, oh, we're being really nice to you. We're going to give you a social equity license. But in terms of, we're not going to help you with real estate. We're not going to help you with education. We're not going to help you with advice that you need to get from lawyers and CPAs and God knows who else.
They had a lot of training programs that they initiated that were actually decent. You know, I think the problem with it is they promise a large amount of financial support. And I think that becomes the biggest piece, you know, when you're dealing with, you know, first time business owners, and you're dealing with a new industry. The first people that get the license are going to be subjected to the most scrutiny. They're going to have they're going to have the hardest time actually crossing over and making this thing work. And they acted like they didn't know that. So out of maybe the first 50 or so dispensaries that were actually put up, you're talking about maybe 10 that were what I consider to be successful. And in terms of what I know the number should be, maybe 5, So, I think it's just, it's becoming of the state and what's been going on.
Here's a question that I've never seen addressed. Maybe you can, because you're a New Yorker. There never seems to be any distinction between the city and upstate in terms of building the industry and working with people who have been, because obviously upstate there's farmers and in town is distribution, and there's a mix of both. I never see anybody get down to that level to understand that maybe they're not two different markets, but people and organizations have to be treated a bit differently. Did you sense that at all, that they didn't really think that out as well?
I mean, there's so much they didn't think out, as it relates to what's going on in the city now, because they have allowed indoor grow. There's a promise there. There's some places in the city it's gonna do those areas extremely well. They're so dilapidated, and there's nothing else that could go into those areas. They're in every borough. There's a particular area that meets those criteria. So I think it's gonna increase the urge for growers to come into the city with this indoor crop, and hopefully it'll increase the urge of out of towners that, have been 20, 30 years in the grow world to come into the city as well and help out and spread the knowledge.
And in the different boroughs, who has the final decision on those sorts of development things? I've lived in New York, but I'm not a New Yorker. Is it the borough or is it the city?
It's still the overall community. So what happens is the OCM, they will basically say, okay, this space is quote unquote regulated in a correct manner. It passes all the regulations as it relates to whatever, by churches, by schools, whatever, once all of those green lights are checked. What happens, the biggest piece is the community board has to approve the person that actually comes in there and takes over that facility or builds that facility up. And that's that we're finding out now, that's becoming a big, big feat as well.
So, I mean, what hoops do people have to jump through to be able to do that? This is the sort of practical information that nobody knows, and only guys like yourself know, because it's not written down and they're not going to tell you. So that's really interesting. Tell us what hoops they're making them jump through.
Yeah, it's a tough hoop. The first one we've been saying, if you really, really, know where you want to position yourself in New York, you want to first find out where that community board holds their meetings. Find out, out of that zip code, in that area, what's going on. And that's the first play, to get yourself familiar with your community board and going in there and introducing yourself. And also attending some of the meetings, just so that you're aware of what's going on in that community, especially if you're not a part of that community.
And how would you find out about the community board? Do they have online information? I mean, where's the best place to start the process?
The best place to do is a 311. Everything in New York is 311. That's what I would say. That's the best thing. You can find out what times and where the community board meets. These are public meetings. Anyone can attend. You just have to find out the information, where exactly they meet, what time. A lot of the stuff is on Zoom now. Since the pandemic, a majority of the stuff is on Zoom. So you don't even really have to, leave your home. You can tap in, a lot of it is just kind of just ask, inquiring, but it starts with a 311. Like, that's just general information in New York. You can call 311 and say, yo, listen, I want to know this right here, all the way to anything in New York, this block, this zip code, And someone should be able to devise out a plan for you to find out more information, you know.
And those New York rules and regs, do you have to have been a resident of New York for a specific period of time to be able to set up, you know, to be able to not to attend the meetings? Obviously, you can attend the meetings, especially if you're on Zoom. But I mean, this is the nitty gritty stuff that people don't tell you, or you have to pay a lawyer a lot of money. Is
you don't. You don't even have to be a part of that community. You know, the thing is, too, the community board, in some instances, you know, are older individuals that have their own discernments about cannabis. And that becomes a fight within itself. I think understanding how to position yourself so that the community that you're trying to service understands that you're of the community, and positioning yourself so that you're giving back to that community. I think that those become, and if you're doing that earnestly, like, you know what I mean? I think those become things that we should be trying to do anyway. You know, I think as we try to regulate the OCM to do things better, right? One of the biggest things is, you know, we should be able to definitively come in and regulate a percentage of the tax money, how that tax money is spent. You know what I mean? There should be like legacy operators that's controlling that. You know what I'm saying? At the least, you know what I'm saying? There should be people that's of the elk of this cannabis world that's actually figuring out ways to contribute those dollars, because we know how those dollars should be spent. You know what I'm saying? And I think having that respect in the same realm of saying, okay, I'm gonna get cannabis money out of this community, and I'll give back portions of that money that ain't got nothing to do with cannabis to that community in ways that, you know, we all configure plans for, coming with those ideas initially and presenting that to the community board, but not doing it because shit, you think that's what's going to get you the license, but doing that because that's the right thing to do. You know what I'm saying?
Because you want to run a business in that community, and just like running any other business, a paint store or whatever, you want the community to come to you and purchase your products, and you want to be able to give back, at the annual whatever day parade or anything. I mean, it's all part of being and talking to people. It's not just about withdrawing money from that community. Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we've seen that time and time again, especially if you talk about, you know, minority communities. You talk about, not only withdrawing all of the resources out of the community, but leaving, you know, diseases, leaving heart attacks, leaving, you know, because you're pumping in the worst elements of products, you know, the worst food, you know, the worst entities that you could put in your body.
Pathway shopping approach.
You feel me? And so, like, you know, so now as we talk about this idea of being able to get these licenses, empower ourselves and empower the community that you go up in there with, I think you got to have a vision that encompasses the bigger picture. And so knowing who your community board is probably your first step. You know what I'm saying? As you kind of pioneer and say, okay, this is where I want to go, and this is the things that I want to kind of do a little differently than what these other, you know, cannabis companies are doing. And if we all think like that, we'll do a world of great that few cities are really, really pressing for or doing. You know what I'm saying?
Okay, here's another question. Apart from the Justice Foundation in New York, are there other informal organizations of legacy operators or legacy individuals that, if you feel like an outsider and you don't want to go to like a really something that's got a website and is organized and is a little bit scary, where else can you go to start getting information about how to withdraw yourself from one part of the economy and start talking about being in another part of the economy?
You know, I'm not,
especially if you're young, I think
I'm not a real good source on that. You know, yeah. I haven't heard of a lot of it, you know, a lot of them. You know, I have seen, over the last few years since cannabis has gotten extremely popular, I've seen a lot of things start to emerge. You know, I think the problem is there's not a lot of national cannabis action going on because of the federal regulations, and that really draws the biggest difficulties as it relates to people understanding how powerful cannabis is, right? You only see it from a localized instance.
Yes.
And so in New York, it wasn't a lot of things that was echoing the sentiments of what Justice Foundation was echoing. It wasn't a lot of people talking about legacy operators allowed in general. You know, it was a lot of legacy operators talking, you know, but it wasn't a lot of people. But you know, you got, you know, people like Dashida Dawson that's created, you know, organizations over the last 3 years. You know, I even tried to, you know, I got with a constituents of legacy operators. We created a organization called LEAF. It's the Legacy Economic Advancement Foundation. You know, and I think there's a number of these things emerging. What ends up happening is, hopefully, you know, we can all develop an organized platform and then figure out ways that we overlap and join forces easily, as organized situations. I got one, you got one. Now we both got one once we, you know, piece things together, because you know, ultimately we all talking about the same things here. You know what I'm saying?
And I've got another question. So these questions lead to other questions. So, like, you know, look, we're a couple of older guys, been around a long time. You know, what happens if you're young, and you know, it's all a bit scary, and you're doing business, but you want to just try and do it in a different way. I mean, I'm an old white guy lives in another country. I've got no advice. But what advice have you got for people who
I
might
mean,
you know, who you're trying to help them do, yeah, because obviously generally in our conversation, we're talking about people over the age of 35, 40. You know, we've all seen stuff, we all know the tricks, and we can all, you know, talk in this sort of language. And then, but you know, we both remember back to when we were young. First rule is don't listen to anybody over the age of 30 anyway, but and do your own thing, which is I agree with that totally. But I mean, I think at the same time, there's nowhere for people to find like mentors who aren't like some guy in a suit or something.
Nah,
But what sort of
difficult,
advice
man.
do you have for people, especially I think also younger women who, you know,
Right.
who's even more scary to try and get involved in this sort of stuff, that the
First
risks
of
you're
all,
making.
I think if you're thinking different, and you got something that's cutting edge and new, that's the way forward. You know, first and foremost, you know, I think especially coming from the younger minds, that's the most invigorating minds. When I go back and think about when we were young, the most invigorating ideas that pushed society forward. And if you think about it from all platforms, it was the younger minds that was doing it. You know, from at that time, a young Bill Gates. It was a young, I forget his name, who passed on, the
Steve
iPhone
Jobs.
guy. Steve. It was these guys were young. They were just coming up. They were the new dudes, and they were coming with something that was actually laughed at that time, because of how powerful it was. The same thing as it relates to, we talked about hip hop earlier, and now is the most powerful genre in the world. You're talking about, you know, a young, you know, Rakim. These guys are taking chances, and sacrificing everything that they, you know, that, you know, other people were considering to
Of
be,
course. I
you
mean,
know, negative.
I'm sure, like, I mean, look, it's a poor example, but I work in a really boring business of legal publishing. And when I first started talking about this 10 years ago to the sort of people that I have to deal with, lawyers, they literally laughed me out the room. Nobody, you know, nobody would speak to me for 5 years. And only now I've been doing it every day for 10 years. Do people, you know, and still a lot of people don't want to speak to me. But I've got about 10% of people now. I've only got 90% to go. So it's whether I'll stay
Well,
on the
that's
planet long enough to do it.
10 is a good start, you know. And I think that's the other piece. The other piece is don't ever stop. You know, that's the other piece of advice, you know. So it's like, if you got something and you know it's authentic to what you believe in, that's the first piece. Go for it, because it's hard to be able to really issue that, you know. That new thing is something special within itself. And then the other piece is like, never quit. You know what I mean? Like, you know, once you stop is when you die. Like, that's it. Like, you know what I mean? So no matter what it takes and what the feedback is as it relates to progress, what other people consider be progress, like, you know, the biggest thing I tell cats all the time is forge your own definitions of what success means, of what progress means, set your own goals, and be accountable to your own self. You know what I mean? And like, don't let nobody else dictate what those things mean to you, you know? And then you find yourself slowly trickling forward, you know what I'm saying? Like, and that's just life, you know what I mean? That's how this shit goes. Like, if you put in work, I don't care what you're doing, you're gonna get better at it. Like, that's just how life works.
That's how it is. I agree.
That's just how it works, you know. So, you know, that's my true advice, you know, never stop, you know what I'm saying? And like, you know, the more different that you are and the more that you believe in your shit, the better you are, you know what I'm saying? Like, so, you know, I was just listening to Kanye, is actually a Jay-Z record that Kanye produced. I know Kanye for a long time, and I remember when he produced his record for, it was a record with this guy named Scarface.
I remember Scarface, yeah.
It's a monumental hip hop record, you know, early 2000s. But I remember when he gave that record to Jay-Z, and you know, he was like, yo, I'm about to take it to this next level. And a lot of producers were just like, yo, you just got a record off to the biggest rapper ever. Like, what's next? Like, what's bigger than that? Like, yo, you're killing them. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, and he just had his own understanding of what success was, and that wasn't enough for him. You know what I'm saying? Like, where some people would have been super, super satisfied, you know what I mean, and they would have been the producer for the rest of their life, and that's it.
Yeah, you got to reinvent and do something new. I mean, some of Kanye's ideas get pretty weird, but you can't accuse him of not trying to reinvent.
Yeah, all of his ideas get weird. Like, let's just keep it 100.
keep it weird. I like keep it weird. Look, Umi, we're running out of time. I think that's a good place to finish for this time around. We didn't even get on to talking about how other places around the world and in the US can look at New York, both on a good and a bad front. So I'll get you back in a couple of months' time, and we'll have the second part of this conversation.
Absolutely. Let's do a whole part where we talk international only. You know, we talk about the things we're doing in Barcelona and in Africa.
Yeah, that would be great, because that's my approach as a global approach. I think justice needs to be global, not local. Global and local is how it should be. Umi, thanks a lot for being on the Justice Podcast.
It was my pleasure, man. And let's keep moving forward and pushing the needle with it. You know what I mean? Give more justice
to the people. The Justice Foundation Podcast, from legacy to legal. Conversations and chats about cannabis weekly. Too much confusion on this land.